June 12, 2012. The Lama Meditation class. We are continuing our detailed discussion and analysis of Lamrim, graded stages of the path. We have gotten quite far already in the presentation of these stages. We have a growing, more and more expanding level of motivation of what we are aiming for and why we're aiming for that and what we hope to accomplish once we have achieved each of these goals. And the initial scope, we're aiming for better rebirth, and what is moving us toward that is appreciation of the precious human rebirth that we have, but it won't last. And if we haven't taken some preventive measure to avoid lower rebirth, that could follow. And we're quite horrified at the horrible amount of suffering in these lower realms. But we see that there is a way to avoid that, and so we put a safe direction in our life of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, working to overcome the causes of suffering, thereby overcoming suffering, and to realize a true cessation of that, and the paths of mind that will lead to that. So that direction is that cessation or stopping, a situation in which all the causes of suffering are gone, and the state of mind that brings that about and results from that. Buddhists have that in full, Sangha in part. So aiming for a better rebirth. Why? Because we're terrified of worse rebirths. And how are we going to get there? We know that there is a way to get to a better rebirth, which is to put the safe direction in our life, and specifically to avoid the causes of that type of rebirth, namely destructive behavior. And what are we going to do with that better rebirth? We're going to continue on the spiritual path. That's the whole purpose of it. Go further, hopefully with the precious human rebirth. Then on the intermediate scope, what are we aiming for? We're aiming for liberation from being free of any type of rebirth. We are just totally disgusted, bored with these rebirth states, the whole cycle, whether it's a better rebirth or a worse rebirth. Still filled with sufferings of birth and growing up and old age and sickness and death and being frustrated, not getting what we want, always having happiness, unhappiness, going up and down, all of this stuff is really quite awful. So just as we were motivated so strongly, have such a strong intention, you know, really moved by this horrendous fear, not only fear, I don't mean that in a paralyzing sense, but just, wow, I really don't want this, you know, terrible rebirth. That, you know, we're driven to get a better rebirth. So it's really thinking of ourselves, in a sense. And the second, this intermediate level, wow, I really have to get out of, you know, any type of rebirth. You know, we see, and it's interesting here, because if you do this strictly, you know, without going, you know, putting in Mahayana into it, then you see various people, you see various animals, and so on, and you're just filled with repulsion, with disgust, in a sense. Disgust in the sense that, wow, I don't want to be like that. I don't want to continue to be reborn and to be like this person or this animal or this or that. I'm just really turned away from all of that. And I think this is the point that is being made when working for your own liberation is really just thinking of yourself, and can have this problem of self-cherishing, despite the fact that you have to overcome grasping for self in order to reach liberation. But on the way toward it, you're just, you're not attracted to anything in ordinary life or any type of rebirth. So, very interesting state of mind. and we look at what are the causes of it. It's any type of karma, compulsive behavior, that compulsiveness about our behavior, which is brought on by disturbing emotions. And so we look at all the disturbing emotions and how that drives rebirth with just general death, mortal rebirth, with the 12 links, etc. And wow, I just don't want that. So we're going to overcome the disturbing emotions and particularly that unawareness of how we exist, which is the basis for the whole chain of the 12 links that describe death and rebirth. So to overcome that, we have to work with discriminating awareness to get that. We need concentration to get that. We need ethical discipline. So that's the way to gain liberation. And what are we going to do once we've gained liberation? Basically, continue to meditate, can be in a pure land or something like that. And just go on. Yeah.
I just want to ask, people seem to have no compassion, as Yuda has described, as you described this state of mind. There is some, in Buddhism, some schools or some direction, there is no compassion.
Well, no, the question is, this state that I just described of the intermediate scope, there doesn't seem to be any compassion, and so is there any school of Buddhism that doesn't have teachings in compassion? I don't think so. You see, what's described as the intermediate scope is not an actual school of Buddhism. Because Theravada, for example, certainly has meditation on the four immeasurables, the Brahma, Viharas. So love, compassion, equanimity, joy. These sort of things. So that's certainly there. In Zen, the approach to compassion is very much like you have in the Confucian philosophy of Mengzi, of Mencius, which is that if you just quiet down enough, that you will get in touch with the basic good nature of human of the mind, and part of the goodness of people is compassion. So this standard Chinese approach, or Confucian approach, is then brought into at least Chan, the Chinese form of what in Japan is called Zen Buddhism. Pure Land, I'm sure, also must have compassion on these things. Bodhisattva vows certainly there. So we shouldn't take this intermediate scope as a specific school of Buddhism, but just a natural progression. And as I've always said, there are two ways of going through Lam Rim. One is the initial way of going through it, in which you don't know what's coming next. And then the next one is that you take the Mahayana motivation as your context, and then go back. I want to better rebirth, and specifically precious human rebirth, in order to continue on the path to enlightenment, to help others. I'm going to gain liberation from uncontrollably recurring rebirths, so that I'm not under the influence of anger and attachment and so on. How can I help others? So everything is within that Mahayana context. But if you just go straight through and you're trying to develop this intermediate scope, on a sincere level. I mean, the first level is hard enough, to really take rebirth seriously and to really believe that destructive behavior is the cause for worse rebirths and suffering. And therefore to refrain from destructive behavior, not because you want to be good, not because, Buddha told you to, but because you really understand and are convinced, not just understand, but are totally convinced that this is going to bring me horrible suffering. So you stop. That's very difficult to reach that point. Very, very difficult. So, you mean you can stop destructive behavior for other reasons, but to do it on the actual intermediate scope reason, that I think is quite difficult. Be sincere about that. But then that intermediate scope, if you really try to develop it, you know, so that you sincerely feel it, there is this danger that you just are almost, I mean, what should we say? You don't want the disturbing emotion of repulsion, because that would be contradictory with the intermediate scope of trying to get rid of the disturbing emotions. But it's sort of just, you have no interest, and you're just turned off, if I can use the colloquial English word, you're just turned off by everybody, by imagining that you're in that situation, and you see other people suffering, and what does it tell you? You know, if we're not considering compassion here, what it tells you is, ooh, I don't want to be reborn and have that kind of problem, no matter what kind of rebirth I might have. Here are the illustration that I have of all the sufferings that everybody has. This is horrible. You're turned off from that. I just don't want that. I really want to get free of all of that. So it's a very self-centered point of view, isn't it?
Seems
to be. Seems to be. But it seems to be a necessary step according to the Lamrim progression. Because otherwise, if you're going to help others, you get involved on a emotional level that's disturbing, because you're attracted to them or you are repelled from them. That's why all the bodhicitta meditations start with equanimity, I think, to counter what you would get from this renunciation in terms of how you relate to other people. So whether I think about it, you know, and recognizing everybody as your mother and so on, you want to reconnect with people after you have really worked on developing this renunciation and disgust for samsara and birth. It seems to make sense to me on an emotional level of how you develop. Yeah, Jorge.
Just think of another context in which you would feel repelled.
Another what that you would?
Context.
Contact?
Context.
Context. In which you would feel repelled.
Like, when, for example, when you are depressed, you would feel off-put and you would not want to take on anything and so on. Or, as you said, you can have a lot of repulsion for something, but I guess it's more, you have to first go to the phase of becoming bored, of becoming... But it's neither of those, it's neither being depressed nor being...
Right, it's not that you are tired, it's not that you're depressed, you're bored with the whole process of rebirth, but it's not that you are... I mean, this is interesting, would you be bored with other people? What are the teachings for going into a solitary retreat? In terms of Shantideva, for example. I mean, in theory, you're going into retreat. You know, may I go off into the forest and live under the trees where I'm not bothered by all these infantile beings that, you know, they just want things from you, and goes through a whole sort of list of how much of a pain infantile beings are. So is it running away from them? I mean, and what you were saying is that you're bored with them. In a sense, there's nothing interesting. There's nothing interesting in interacting.
Nothing more that you can get.
You've done it a million to zillion times. And now what? And where has it gotten you? Nowhere. So, this is, I think, a difficult state of mind to overcome, to go on to the next step. Mm-hmm. So, in many ways, it's interesting that in the presentation of Lamrim, Tsongkhapa cuts short the intermediate scope. You know, in the intermediate scope, you're supposed to have the three higher trainings, and so you should have all the teachings on Shamatha and Vipassana there, you know, concentration and the understanding of voidness. But it doesn't put it there. You know, what is there is vows. First of the three higher trainings, ethical discipline, Why? Because that would be a logical thing that you would do if you developed renunciation. I'm bored with everything in ordinary life, getting me nowhere. It's not interesting. You know, that is a higher level than being repelled by it and turned off by it. But I'm bored with it, because that has the danger of a disturbing emotion. But I'm bored with it, and so I really am attracted to liberation. So the vows for individual liberation, pranimoksha, how to gain liberation. What do I need for liberation? Why do you take vows? Vows are for discipline. Why do you become a monk or a nun? Because you need the discipline. It gives you the discipline, the vows and the schedule and so on of a monastery. And then, within that, you go off into retreat, if you have that capacity. So, Tsongkhapa is saying, you know, by shortening this discussion in the intermediate scope, I think he's saying, you know, be careful here. And how does he start the advanced scope? It's, you haven't fulfilled all your own purposes, and you haven't fulfilled the purposes of others. So there's more that you could accomplish. Then we get the advanced scope. So it's very interesting. The more that you analyze, the more that you think about the order of the Lamrim, and what does it mean to actually develop it on an emotional, deep, sincere level. Really quite amazing. Yeah.
So it's the first time that I hear that you can board off some themes, you know, aspect of intermediate scope. As I remember, it's always right as such. So the relations between these beings. I think there could be a difference between being board of beings and right to them.
Right. Well, I'm just taking this to a logical conclusion. He's saying that, to repeat, if that was too soft, that in the normal, or the usual presentation of the intermediate school scope, you're bored with samsara, meaning, you know, rebirth and so on. It's not that you are bored with other samsaric beings, but I'm taking it to its logical conclusion. The logical conclusion is that you're not interested in anything except liberation. So why would you be interested in other beings? Because they're suffering. That's advanced scope. That's compassion. If we take the intermediate scope by itself, without compassion, so you start to see the importance of compassion even more strongly, of how you could really become, well, I don't know, I mean, there's a danger of becoming bitter. And that you certainly don't want either. So, I don't know. I mean, if you are someone of the intermediate scope, what does it say in all the texts? The garland of, you know, Bodhisattva garland of gems, the Vatisha, or Shantideva as well. You know, stay away from infantile beings, but if you encounter them, you know, have a smile, be nice. But be like the honeybee was Shantideva's image, that just gets to the flower as, you know, takes the essence, so has the essence of a interaction and leaves, doesn't get stuck in the flower. But Shantideva says that, doesn't he? Don't get stuck with anyone. Which is an interesting thing, is that contradictory with taking on their suffering and getting involved? How involved do you get? Do you take into your home every homeless being? Every stray cat? There are some questions. How involved do you get?
Can be there an answer at such individual, like, what are you born for this life to? What is your task? It must be individual different. I mean, some
right,
people live in the cave and put every cat and every flower and every bee someplace and be holy to them, but...
Right, so she's saying that everybody has a different capacity, everybody has a different way in which to follow the path, and that His Holiness says as well, in terms of if you're following the Mahayana path, then he says a very, very tiny percentage are those who can really just meditate their whole life, go into a lifelong retreat. That's very, very tiny. Tiny amount. So for the vast majority, it's much better to be socially involved in some sort of beneficial way with society and meditate part of the time. But, you know, who are you fooling that you're going to be able to, you know, be by yourself in a cave for the rest of your life meditating? For most people, they'd go crazy.
It must fit to me and to my life.
Right, it must fit to me and my life. Now, that becomes an interesting question. Fit to me in my life. Does that imply that we have a fixed personality and it's permanent and it can never be changed? Me in my life might be that I'm an alcoholic.
No, what?
So, you know.
I wanted to say something different.
So it doesn't fit together.
So it doesn't fit together.
I can't drink anymore.
Yeah, you know.
No, but I see the danger of this theoretic talk we have now maybe puts us in a situation we think, we should be like that. I would just say that for me it's important that I can. Hat man das in mein Leben bringen?
Dass ich das bring it in my life.
Yeah, to bring it in my life and to not to bring it by head, just to live, really to live it, you know?
Right,
not
so
to be
we
in
see
the head like maybe I'm this and I feel
right,
good,
so
but
to
really to live it.
Right, so we have to live it, and living it means to be realistic in terms of what we can do. And this also is general advice that's always given. See what is it that you are most talented in, and use those talents. So you might be very gifted in terms of being able to relate easily to others. You might be gifted in terms of being very intelligent, able to explain things clearly, or whatever it is that you are gifted in. But then the issue becomes, if you are very, let's say, emotional or very intellectual, to be balanced, don't you need to train on the other side?
Yes.
And yes, you do. Yes, you do. But do you go to the extreme and ignore, you know, what is your strong side? No. You keep that and add. Yeah.
It's good to get this set back to this intermediate scope.
So let's go back to intermediate scope.
Because there's something that I want to clarify, because you asked the question of other schools of Buddhism apart from Mahayana. Is it because the Torah, but the Buddhists have all these, you know, quotation and stuff like that. So that is, I mean, is it then a part of the advanced scope within Theravada Buddhism, or is it just that compassion plays a certain role in intermediate scope as well?
Okay, so now he's asking, what's the place of compassion in the Theravada training? And is it with an intermediate scope or advanced scope? Do they have an advanced scope? I've not studied Theravada deeply, so I can't speak authoritatively. Maybe one of you have, but I don't think they have anything like a Lamrim, like a graded stages of motivation. I doubt that. Seriously doubt that. They certainly have the training in ethics and concentration and so-called wisdom, discriminating awareness, that they definitely have. And they definitely have these 37 factors leading to Bodhi, a purified state, you know, starting with the placement of the four close mindfulnesses, Satipatthana, you know, and going on from there, the Eightfold Path, etc. That they certainly have. And where the meditation on the four Brahmaviharas, you know, compassion, love, joy, and equanimity fit into that, I'm not quite sure. There is a graded path of the these 37 facets in terms of you know, on each of the five paths leading to arhatship, to leadership, you know, to, you know, the path of so-called accumulation or building up, and then applying or preparation and seeing, and then meditation or accustoming, and then, you know, that's graded. So that you certainly have in Theravada. So, I don't know, and within Satipatthana, it certainly levels of it and a graded path of how you go deeper and deeper with it. But anyway, I don't think there's these three levels of motivation. So how compassion fits into their path in a structured way, I don't know. A Theravada. In any case, we're talking here about the Lam Rim. So let's get back to the Lam Rim and how we would develop ourselves. And the main point of this intermediate scope is that, you know, with the Tsongkhapa makes it very nicely when he talks about renunciation in the intermediate Lam Rim. There he differentiates two levels of renunciation, and he refers to it in terms of what you turn away from. And so the first one is turning away from your main interest being in this lifetime, and the second one is turning away from your main interest being in any type of rebirth, future lifetimes. So this is the point, that if one wants to develop sincere concern for others, that, you know, you have to take away, what should we say, you know, to give up or renounce. You know, I want to become rich in this lifetime, or famous, or, you know, go sightseeing and see every place, you know, in the world, or whatever. Tourist of samsara, as my teacher used to say. We don't want to be that, and turn away from, you know, just working for future lives, for myself. Then you turn away. I mean, this is the, in the Sakya, they have the turning away from the four clingings. Mm-hmm. The same idea. And then turn away from clinging to just your self-interest. So it's a progressive turning away.
Yeah. The fourth clinging?
Fourth clinging is to true existence. Right.
And
pardon?
And 1, 2, 3, 4?
1, 2, 3, 4. Now, I'm not absolutely positive on this. So let's leave it. Okay, so intermediate scope. I'm just talking about, you know, what I'm trying to work with, at least to myself, and I think that this is a way of working with it, is that, sure, we have worked with the Lam Rim, studied it for, many of us, for decades. Now, do you actually sincerely feel any of it? And am I sincerely an initial scope? Do I sincerely have that? And it's emphasized over and again that if you try to get the advanced scope without having the foundation of the initial and the intermediate scope, it's going to be shallow, it's going to be incomplete, it's not going to work. You're going to have problems. As in getting attached to others and then yelling and acting in a destructive way and so on when you're trying to help them. Because people are difficult to help. They don't take your advice. So you lose patience, etc. So, what would it really feel like to have that initial scope, and what would it really feel like to have that intermediate scope? Like, this is not just theoretical, but how does that actually feel, and to feel it, and to then integrate it into my life, and what difference does it make to my life? And what I'm doing, and what my priorities are. It implies quite a big change in our priorities. You know, as Holiness has always said, you know, 50-50, we have to be practical. So 50% working for, you know, this life and, you know, all the various things of this life, but 50% on the Dharma goals.
So we can be 50% interested in other people around us, mm-hmm. and 50%...
Well, I'm not saying that I'm not interested in people around us. I'm not saying that this is the... I mean, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that what we want to cultivate is being disinterested in people around. I'm saying that what I notice in trying to develop this is that when you start to feel that intermediate scope... of, you know, I just want liberation. That one consequence of it, and maybe it's a danger, you know, perhaps we can put it as a danger, is that you're just turned off by anybody. Because it's just an example of samsara, of what I don't want in myself.
Turned off doesn't sound like a good feeling. Or
it doesn't sound like a good feeling, but is what's the difference between being turned off and turning away from? You see other people as an illustration of a samsaric rebirth. So it is, unless you bring in Mahayana, again, we're not talking about Theravada as an illustration, but unless you bring in compassion, what is the basis for a relationship? What's your attitude toward others?
We're not allowed to bring in compassion because we're not on the advanced
scope. Right, you're not allowed to bring in compassion now because we're not on the advanced scope. We're just talking theoretical now. I mean, obviously, the way that you know, as I was saying, this is the initial way of developing Lamrim, that you don't know what's coming next. Now, when you do know it, so you've never heard of Mahayana, right? You're just intermediate scope. And what would be the consequence of that? And the consequence of that is that, samsara. Everybody just illustrates samsara. Turn away from that. I want liberation. Get thee to a nunnery, you know? I mean, and even in a monastery or a nunnery, you're not interested in socializing. Now, of course, on a realistic level, we are social beings. And so if you become very stiff and we are compassionate, that's basic, you know, biology. His Holiness always points that out. So if you are, you know, you go off and I'm going to be a monk or I'm going to be a nun or I'm going to be a great yogi and I'm going to do my mantra, you know, 24 hours a day, the preliminary prostrations, and I'm going to, you know, do all of this, and you can't relate to others, then one has to really question what's going on here. Because it could be fear. You know, you're afraid of getting involved. Well, I was afraid of going to a worse rebirth, and therefore I refrained from destructive behavior. So now, am I afraid to get involved with people because I'll develop a disturbing emotion? But then you look at the 37 Bodhisattva practices and says that, you know, if staying with those who are, you know, familiar in your home and so on is going to just cause attachment and repulsion, etc., to arise, better to leave. One of the Bodhisattva practices. Leave those objects that will cause you disturbing emotions to boil over when you can't handle it. Now, obviously, the Bodhisattva training is once you can handle it, come back. Look at the yogi training. First you train in completely silent places. Then the advanced yogi comes back and practices at busy crossroads. You know, where there's a lot of traffic and noise and, you know, these charnel grounds where they leave bodies to rot and so on. Go back and practice, you know, in busy crowds. You know, and then see how good your concentration is, etc. You know, it's easier when it's quiet. So there's always coming back. So I'm just questioning all these things, and I think it's important to question what does it actually feel like and what are the dangers. And I think this is one of the dangers, is that you're turned off from people and situations and so on unless you bring in the compassion.
The reason that some people don't want to get out of retreat anymore.
Is it the reason why some people don't want to get out of retreat anymore? For sure. I mean, you did, 2-3 year retreats.
Yeah.
So you have the experience that for some people it's hard to integrate back. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, what drives you? I mean, they often accuse monks and nuns of that. Mm-hmm. That, you know, they're becoming a monk and nun because they are, you know, they can't relate in a partnership, and they're afraid. So they run off. Now, is this a valid reason? And I think the problem with it is it makes you stiff. And when you're stiff, what is that? You know, you're hanging on truly existent vows. Truly existent, you know, me that has to be disciplined and so on. Otherwise, you know, the bad me. So the good me has to control the bad me. Type of thing. And is that beneficial to start with? This is the question. Is it better than just being wild? Probably. But has to be seen as an obstacle. So I think also in this progression of Lam Rim, one also needs to watch out for the obstacles that could come up on each of these stages, and why you would need to go on to the next stage. And I pointed out the obstacle in the initial scope is that I want a better rebirth because I want to continue being with my loved ones and my guru and, you know, all the, you know, the teachings and so on. And so there's tremendous attachment to that. You don't imagine that, you know, you're never going to see them again for a zillion years. You know, I want to continue with them. But that's the danger. There's a lot of attachment there.
Looking for security.
Looking for security. I want continuity. But I don't want to give up what I have now. So let me continue with it. Basically is what you want. And then everybody wants to be a tulku, you know, so that they, you know, encounter the same people and so on. Danger with this intermediate scope, I think, is this being turned off by everybody.
I think that regarding the fear that in our common everyday life, we are not always conscious of the fact, but we somehow feel that the destructive emotions and behavior of all people around us can be contagious and get rubbed off on us.
Right.
And we're just not conscious that we have that we feel fearful, but
right,
we're not conscious that is, you know, fear is coming from that.
Right, so fear is coming also, he says, from feeling that just as we could catch a cold from somebody, we could also catch their anger or their attachment. That's very, very common. Very common. You know, everybody else is smoking, and so we smoke. Everybody else is drinking, so you want to fit in, so you drink. But they're watching television, so you watch television with them. Pardon?
Can be very hard, but I experienced last.
Yeah. Right, and that's a very difficult thing to deal with.
Okay.
Very difficult thing. So there can also be this fear of why you want to go off into a solitary life. Mind you, one shouldn't idealize the monasteries and nunneries from having lived in them. Oh, great, what should we say, sanctuary from these various worldly activities. But anyway, we're trying to develop this intermediate scope. So develop the good points of it, this renunciation, and watch out for the drawbacks, you know, the dangers that could be there. And I guess what I was expressing was my experience of some of these dangers that one has. You just, turned off by everything. All you want is liberation. And then what is really essential is to realize what you have to do to gain liberation and be willing to do it and then actually do it and not just be turned off by, you know, so-called samsara and want out but you're not willing to do anything, or you don't know how to get out, or you're not confident that it's possible to get out. Then you get, of course, discouraged. So this is why it's so important and very, very difficult to become convinced. First of all, you have to know what in the world does it mean to be liberated or to be enlightened? And secondly, to be convinced that it's actually possible. And third, to be convinced that I can do it, not just Buddha did it. Without these, very shaky and very shaky grounds. Because then I'm aiming for something that I don't even know is possible. So this is another attitude that some people have, and they find that it's quite okay to do. That it is like in mathematics, approaching the limit. You never can reach that limit, but you can approach it. And if I can go in that direction of becoming a Buddha, certainly things will improve. And whether or not I can actually reach that limit, I don't care. But going as far as is possible, you know, in that direction is going to be fantastic. Now, that's a very interesting question. Mm-hmm. Is that sufficient? Yeah.
Obviously, the Tantra teachings show that the opposite approach is the best, that you really take the reality to the path. You really
Right. The Tantra teaching says take the result as the path, which means that imagine that you already are a Buddha. Or the Jonangbo says the result is the basis. So they say enlightenment is there already. You just have to uncover it. There on the basis level, so they bring it even further. This is another school of Tibetan Buddhism. So the limit goes from the other side. He's saying, yeah, right. But I'm saying that if, what should we say? This is a commonly experienced attitude that I found with Westerners, and I find that in myself as well. Whether or not you can actually reach enlightenment, I don't know. Whether or not His Holiness or the Karmapa or who knows who was actually enlightened, how in the world do I know? But they were pretty far in that direction. And that's good enough. As my friend Alan used to say, if I could become like His Holiness, I would be more than satisfied. Whether His Holiness is a Buddha or not, how do I know? Who am I to say? It says in the teachings, only a Buddha can recognize another Buddha. So, how can we know if somebody is a Buddha? Oh, anyway, we are getting completely off track in terms of our progression in the Lamrim, but I think that this is very helpful. So, then we see that if there are these dangers, each of these steps, the danger with the initial scope was that you're attached to being with all your friends and your relatives and your teachers and so on in future lives. So, what did we start off with to counter that? Is the disadvantages of, a better rebirth. And, hey, wait a second, it's not that cool. You still are going to have, tremendous problems, even if you continue with your loved ones and so on. So that, that helps us to overcome that danger. And the same thing with the intermediate scope. If, we're just, I've got to get out of this horrible, like getting out of a fire type of thing. Actually, that image of the fire, if you look at the grammar of the text in which it is, in which it appears, usually it's translated as, you want to get out of samsara, like wanting to get out of a fire. It doesn't mean that. It means that I'm not going to turn away from aiming for liberation, even if I were on fire. And then that fits very well with this self-immolation and all of this sort of thing, that even if I set myself on fire, I'm still, I'm not going to be, I'm in pain and freak out and so on. I want liberation. That's not going to turn me from working for liberation. That you see in the grammar of the Sanskrit, which is a much stronger thing, much stronger statement.
You're saying both interpretations are possible, or just the second one?
The second one is justified by the grammar. The first one is how it's often explained.
So like in the 37?
In the 37 practices. Okay, so
much stronger motivation then.
It's a much stronger motivation.
Much stronger, unbelievable.
So, with the advanced stuff, now you're, turned off. So, and it's difficult to relate to others because they just illustrate samsara to me and the type of rebirth that I don't want. Now we have to overcome this tendency with equanimity toward everybody and realizing everybody has been our mother. And we're all equal and so on. So then it makes perfect sense in the logical sequence of how we develop ourselves. You take one step forward, and then you have to watch out because there's some side effects that could cause problems, and you have to correct that in going on to the next steps in our, basically it's an emotional development. An emotional development. You know, we're not talking about intellectual development. We're talking about, you know, your actual feeling, what motivates you. Okay, so the advanced scope, we've gone through the two different ways of developing up to bodhicitta. So we haven't, although I said it briefly before, we have the 11-round bodhicitta meditation. We get this in Popoka's Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, Namjo Lachang in Tibetan. I don't know if it comes earlier. I haven't really examined the earlier lamrims that came between Tsongkhapa and Popoka. They're separated by around 500 years, a little more than 500 years, so could have been in an earlier one that these are developed. Because these two methods are put together. So it's first equanimity, you know, being free of attraction, repulsion, or indifference. Then awareness of everyone as our mother. And then number three, mindfulness of our mother's kindness. And this is both when they've been our mother and at other times as well. At all times, they've been kind to us. Remember, we had in this equalizing, the nine rounds of equalizing, that their kindness outweighs any nastiness they've had, because, you know, whatever we eat, whatever, you know, road that we go on, whatever clothing we wear, comes from the work of others. And then gratitude for motherly love, you know, the thing to want to pay it back, that you feel really, really grateful, which brings on heartwarming love. So all of that is number four. Then the equality of self and others comes after that. You know, so we, you know, really feel warm toward the others, and then we have equality. That, you know, they and we are equal. We all want happiness. We don't want unhappiness. Bring in the nine points that we discussed. We can apply that just to everybody else, that they're all equal, or we can apply it to ourselves, and then the faults of self-cherishing, and then the benefits of cherishing others, and then Donglen is combined with giving happiness with love and taking on the suffering of others with compassion. Right. Now, after that, 10th step is the exceptional resolve. The exceptional resolve is that I'm going to do it. With compassion, we you know, feel that we want to do it. You know, I mean, intend to do it, I should say. How does it... Honka points out that the difference between the compassion and this exceptional resolve is compassion is I intend to help. You know, it's not just may everybody be free of suffering and the causes of suffering, but you actually take some responsibility. I intend to help them. But the exceptional resolve is that I definitely will help them. It's not just good intentions. I definitely will help them and help them all the way to enlightenment. Not just to get rid of their hunger and stuff like that. So that's the exceptional resolve. So you really make very strong determination. I'm going to do it. I will do it. And then comes bodhicitta. And the thoughts are that, how can I do it? You know, I do this Donglen, but, you know, nothing much is going to actually happen. So the only way that I can really help them is if I gain enlightenment. And this is where Popoka comes in. He says that before this bodhicitta step, you realize that just attaining liberation, I'm not going to be able to help them. Remember, we already were aiming for liberation. I'm not going to be able to help them. That's not enough, because I don't know cause and effect fully. I don't know really what's the best way to help them. And so I haven't actually gone as far as you can go in my development. So I haven't fulfilled all my own purposes as well. So you review that. Then you aim at enlightenment. And then Tsongkhapa puts in that before that, you know, I think it would come after this, well, maybe before, I don't know, but you'd have to see, is to review the qualities of a Buddha. Buddha's body, speech, mind, and enlightening influence. So that you really become, you know, why do you want to become a Buddha? help, because Buddha can multiply into a zillion bodies and, you know, help others simultaneously, and Buddha speaks and everybody understands it in their own language and in their own way. He knows exactly what to say that's going to help others. His mind, he has equal love, equal concern for absolutely everybody. He understands fully cause and effect, enlightening influence. He doesn't have to do anything, because just the way that he is inspires others to quiet down their disturbances and so on, to stimulate their things to grow, to get everything in order. This is the power type of thing, that everything is in order and under control, so it works with them. And then forceful thing, you know, to sort of wake them up if they're really acting in a, you know, completely deluded way. So just by the Buddha's way of being, it stimulates this. Doesn't have to do anything. That's how a Buddha can benefit and help everybody simultaneously throughout the universe. It's not that he actually has to go and help, you know, the little old lady across the street. So, these are the things that we want to develop. And then Atisha adds, in his auto commentary to Lamp for the Path, he adds that you need certain states of mind that are going to accompany bodhicitta. Bodhicitta then is aimed at my not yet happening enlightenment that we can impute on our mental continuum, but it hasn't happened yet. And we can label me on the entire mental continuum, just as we label me. You know, when we see a picture of ourselves as a baby, we say, well, that was me. Or any period in our life, that's still me. So we can label me on future lives, we can label me on our eventual state of a Buddha. So, and then I'm going to make that, I will make that happen. And why? To actually benefit and help others. So with that, what do we need? As the cluster of mental factors around that bodhicitta. And it's interesting here, because what do you have? You have love and compassion and the exceptional resolve. They're there. They have different objects focused on something different from bodhicitta. Remember, we had this, I don't know if you remember, but we had it in the discussion of mental factors. Maybe we didn't have it in this class. With mental factors, there are the mental factors that accompany a primary consciousness. Primary consciousness is your mental consciousness focused on enlightenment. That the mental factors around it, like concentration and attention and feeling and, you know, all these other things, are going to share five things in common. So you can take the same focal object, they're going to be focused with the same mental hologram, they're going to occur at the same time. There's a list of five that go on there. I'm not absolutely positive of the list of five, but I can just recite them. But anyway, they all fit together in the same slant. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So they have these five things in common, congruent. Now, love and compassion are not aimed at my not yet attained enlightenment. Love and compassion are aimed at all sentient beings, and they're suffering, and you want them to be free of it, and for them to be happy. So, Sekhar Rinpoche explained that these are separate states of mind, that we want to generate them, and you generate them before bodhicitta, and you sort of have them in the background, but your main attention is on bodhicitta. So in a sense it takes the flavor, but it's not that you are focusing with compassion on the suffering of other beings while you're focusing on enlightenment. That's sort of almost subterranean, subconscious in that state of mind. In other words, we can have, he says, it's interesting that even samadhi, single-pointed concentration, doesn't mean that you have only that going on. You have something else going on as well. It's just a matter of your attention isn't there. So when you are totally absorbed for instance, on focusing on something, you might still be hearing, you might still be feeling the temperature of the room, but you're just not paying any attention to it. But that's still going on. So the same thing, you know, your love and compassion is there. It's generated. But now, so it flavors what you're doing with the bodhicitta. But this is but Atisha gives a list of what are the factors that are actually accompanying bodhicitta. And he's saying that this is engaged bodhicitta. So it's not just, you know, the wish to attain enlightenment engaged. You know, I'm going to actually now do the practices that are going to bring me there. And so he says, we've said this before, so I won't go into too much detail. You have to be sincere about this. And sincere means without hypocrisy. You're not hiding your faults. And you're not pretentious. You're not pretending to have qualities that you don't have. So it's interesting, even when we are imagining that we're a Buddha in Tantra, and you imagine that you have all these qualities, you know that actually you're not fooling yourself into thinking that I'm really like this, and then, you know, I can walk through the wall and you smash into a wall.
Fortunately,
something like that, to use a silly example. And not hiding our faults means to be honest and straightforward and to be clear and open. So I'm honest, you know, I'm striving for enlightenment, very sincere about that, but I'm not going to, you know, try to hide my faults. I'm not going to pretend that I'm, you know, so fantastic that I don't get angry. His Holiness even says in interviews on television that he still gets angry sometimes. Mm-hmm. Doesn't last for, you know, more than a couple seconds, but he gets angry. So you're honest and straightforward, you're clear and open, and lack of pretension means that you're not contrived or artificial, you know, putting on a show, you know, I'm the great white guru, I'm the great bodhisattva, the saint, you know, Buddha type of thing, and to have a pure motivation, not mixed with ulterior motives. You know, I'm not doing this to be famous, I'm not doing this, you know, so I'll get a lot of people who like me, and so on. None of that. And so that's sincerity. That's one thing that accompanies. And then exceptional sincerity has two more factors. Non-attachment, which means that we are not liable to lose this aim because of attachment to some other goal, whatever that goal might be. And not liable to suffer a loss of joyful perseverance because of attachment to something else. So it's what does it mean? Exceptionally sincere. There's no danger that I'm going to stop working for enlightenment because I'm attached to another goal, and there's no danger that I'm going to lose my joyful perseverance because I'm attached to something else. You know, I'm not going to give up my energy. I'm going to work toward this, you know, with enthusiasm, joy, and so on. And going forward, there's also there that we're going to work on, you know, reaching enlightenment, which means building up the two networks, positive force and deep awareness. Positive force and deep awareness through the six perfections, the six far-reaching attitudes. So this is what is going to accompany that state of bodhicitta. So you can see that meditating on bodhicitta is incredibly complex and has many, many things that we are aware of. So we've built up with these 10 steps. Bodhicitta is the 11th step of really feeling something, you know, based on having this initial and intermediate motivation. Really feeling, you know, there's nothing else that I want. Nothing else that I want except to reach enlightenment. And of course, to reach enlightenment, I'm going to have to continue having precious human rebirths, and I'm going to have to gain liberation from attachment and karma and all this sort of stuff, rebirth. So, aiming at nothing else that I want in life. And I realize that I haven't fulfilled my purposes, I haven't fulfilled the purposes of others unless I reach that. I'm aware of what enlightenment is, so the qualities of the Buddha, and doesn't say in the Lam Rim, of Tsongkhapa, but we'll say this in other presentations. You're aware of Buddha nature factors so that you know that you can achieve enlightenment. So here it's just implicit in terms of the two networks that you have. You know, this is the basic Buddhist, the most basic type of Buddha nature is the two networks, positive force and deep awareness, that, you know, this can be developed. And then the nature of the mind and all this sort of stuff. But anyway, you realize that it is possible. And so with that love and compassion underlying it, and completely sincere, and I'm totally honest, and I'm not going to hide my faults, and I'm not attached to anything else, so there's no danger that I'm going to blow it, to leave it. So all of that strength is there. Then, focus on it. So, let us try to do that. And how do you focus on not yet attained enlightenment? As I said, it needs to be represented by something. It needs to have a focal object. So it could be a visualized Buddha. It could be your guru. It's done with guru yoga. So either your actual guru or... Shanga Karkyu, I heard that they actually visualize the guru in their actual form. In most other traditions, you visualize the guru in the form of one of these yidams, meditational deity, or as one of the founders of your tradition, or something like that. In any case, and actually I've heard as well that if you can't visualize it like that, visualizing in their own form is okay, but not as an old sick person or something like that. So anyway, be represented by the guru. That this is what I'm aiming for. This is my not yet attained enlightenment. It can be represented by, in Mahamudra, much more difficult to do, the nature of the mind itself. It's representing the not yet attained enlightenment. So that's all there. Or in Tantra, yourself visualized as a Buddha and one of these meditational deity forms. Whatever form that might be, there are thousands of them. So all of that is involved with bodhicitta. So very, very strong meditation, and not so easy. So let's try to do it in our last minutes today. And I don't know, it would take too long for me to go through all the different steps that are there. But try to remember them. Equanimity. I mean, the thing is that equanimity is not starting on nothing. So, initial scope, I just human rebirth. I want to attain better human rebirths, and I want to attain liberation. Then, this equanimity, and everybody's been my mother, etc., etc., all equal, and work up like that. And mind you, the eventual goal is that, for instance, at the time of death, just in an instant, you can just get the bodhicitta motivation going, because death will not wait for you to go through all the steps. So one needs to be trained well enough so that this is our dying thought, rather than "oh shit, it's over" as our dying thought. So that's why we train with meditation, more and more familiar, so it's more and more easy, so you can do it more quickly. Okay, once we actually are able to get some sort of taste for what this bodhicitta state of mind and heart would be like, I think it's only then that you can really appreciate the long list of the benefits of developing bodhicitta, and to realize how incredible this state of mind is. And also, I think one starts to appreciate how it's indispensable to have bodhicitta for any sort of tantra practice. To imagine that you are one of these deities without this bodhicitta, let alone without the understanding of voidness. But as it says in the text, and certainly my teachers have emphasized this, that if you try to practice tantra, imagining that you're one of these deities without bodhicitta, this acts as a cause to be reborn as a ghost in the form of that deity. As a ghost. in the form of the deity that you are visualizing yourself as, because you're attached to it and you're taking it as, not only that you're taking it as real, but as solid, but that you're attached to it. You're not doing this to reach enlightenment, that it's not representing enlightenment. You don't even know what enlightenment is. So, what I found very interesting, this is my own theory, I traveled a bit in Southeast Asia, and in Southeast Asia you find a great deal of channeling, in which people are channeling spirits. You know, Maitreya Buddha, Laughing Buddha. Laughing Buddha is the Chinese form of what they call Maitreya Buddha, and various other Buddhas, that these people go into some sort of trance, and these entities speak through them, or they have special writing where they write things, and it's a very, very widespread phenomenon. Particularly, I've seen in Malaysia and Singapore, I think probably in Indonesia as well. And my theory for that is that you had Mahayana flourishing here, and you might have had practitioners who are practicing tantra without this proper bodhicitta, and they're reborn as these spirits in the form of these deities, Laughing Buddha, etc. But they also had compassion, love and compassion as part of their practice, and so they are wanting to help others. And this is the form of therapy that people go to for advice and so on. They go to somebody that channels one of these figures, and they get this sort of advice. And so that was at least my way of trying to understand this very widespread phenomenon in these countries. And it would make sense from a Dharma point of view. So it's not that they are some tortured, hungry ghost or something like that, but still they're a spirit. And one has to be very careful then. And really practice bodhicitta sincerely. This is the gem of the teachings, as they say. So let's end with a dedication. We think whatever understanding, whatever positive forces come from this, may go deeper and deeper and act as a cause to reach enlightenment for the benefit of all.